wherever you want when you get 5 minutes.
I'm doing my best. Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me. It's a while since I've been at the John Hume Summer School, and it's still the same place, still talking away, so it's great. Do remind you of that thing that the Pope's meant to say, or the Dalai Lama's meant to say to the Pope, which is before you start, you meant to take the sense of your audience and have the sense of very well for the
conclusion. You don't get out much, do you?
That's because they've been working so hard all week, they've been engaged in intellectual discussion.
In 6 years' time, Northern Ireland will be 100 years old, which for a failed statelet is a remarkable performance. Irish politics, we're used to telling the story from an Irish political point of view, from Creagan Carson and Pearson Connolly and the rest. But I would like to slightly stand back. I'm a political scientist after all, and actually, when you ask this question about a region, you might get a very long, boring answer, but let's just start with a couple of things. On one level, Northern Ireland wasn't just local, it was part of the Great Wave, which said that if you don't determine your own future, you're under a turning. It came from the American Revolution, the English Revolution, it came from the French Revolution, and it was rolling right through us. If you don't get to choose your own place, it's eternity. And it came to pass, in our case, at the point of the collapse of the old world order, just at the end of the war, when the empires fell. And these demanded that empires and powers based on inheritance and possession gave way to participation and choice. Woodrow Wilson, the very model of Ulster Scots Presbyterianism, both moral and dour, proclaimed an age of national self-determination in place of the empires, or at least in the bits that were now up for grabs. Over 18 months, the Allies tried to square the circles of a promise of freedom and the old empires. By the end, one thing was clear. Wilson's promise could only be fulfilled for some and not for all. Empires weren't just, it turned out, ideological land grabs. But in practice, they were complex, they were organic, they were the products of power and history, of religion and ideology, of commerce and industry. All efforts to apply a template of nation and empire, good and bad, free and unfree, that the nationalists, the socialists, the liberals wanted, crashed against the rock of specificity, that's a good word, of complexity and of partiality. What was freedom here was disaster there. What was simple and straightforward here was complex and perplexing there. Freedom for Czechs in Prague was simple, but it wasn't easy in the boundaries of the Sudeten land over the heads of the locally dominant Germans. Poland, carved up by the great powers in the 18th century, could be free at last, but without a corridor to the sea, Poland would be crippled from the beginning, and that meant overriding the Germans in Danzig. Just what did the Croats, Serbs, Muslims and Slovenes in the Balkans want? Could and should the Balts and Finns get their own country, or did realism dictate that that was the Russian sphere of influence? And as for the Arabs, Jews, Kurds and Persians, Sykes and Pico should do the best they can. And what about the Jews living everywhere else but never safe? Empires were not just empires, but agglomerates, particularities, interactions, contradictions. They weren't simply nations, but places and histories and politics and experiences. Not just nations or monocultural or monolingual, but different and complex and variable. Variations on a theme, perhaps, but different by degree, by intensity, and incapable of resolution on a single model of the nation, or the island, or the historic homeland, or the faith. They were, to coin a phrase, regional. All were a part, not just a part. They were part and not just a part. Not to say that the re-nationalists didn't try. Ah, those Turks, which is the earth of Kit. Driven from power in Europe, they were in no mood to accommodate Greeks or Armenians in their remnant Anatolian homeland. Long before ISIS, Ataturk moved to close down on thousands of years of Greek history. Literally millions of Armenians and Greeks were driven from their homes or slaughtered. The nation couldn't accommodate the other. Self-determination required self-assertion. The variation must give way to the theme. And so it has proved. For nationalist Parlel is right. No man, and I use man, has the right to fix the boundary of the march of a nation. Certainly Hitler didn't believe it. And so the balance of Posen and Pomerania, Bohemia and Moravia were ruthlessly driven to their logical conclusion. Molotov and Stalin weren't diverse either. In the Ukraine, Belarus, Poland and the Baltics, the most diverse communities in Europe were destroyed and massacred. The historian Tim Snyder, in his fantastic book Bloodlands, says that 15 million people were massacred by deliberate policy action of the state in that part of Europe between 1933 and 1945, and that doesn't count people who died as a result of the war. That's just policy. Policy killed. And so to Ireland. Wilson passed on by. Britain was on the winning side. He didn't get to tell us what to do, but his coattails caught us all, and the careful balances being worked out by home rule were ripped into by war. In the face of revolution by Republicans and the threat of insurrection from Unionists, the British government drew a pragmatic line in Ireland. Not nine counties, but six. Home rule, but only for the North, as it turned out, and not as we had known it. All with the fail-safe majority. Not a country, or a province, or a region, but a jurisdiction. For a place that nobody fought for, it's had 100 years' life. By 2020, Northern Ireland will have outlived most of the rest of the map that Wilson designed. Czechoslovakia, gone. Yugoslavia, erupted. Poland, moved. Soviet Union, over. Baltics, been gone and back again. Northern Ireland was made before it was imagined. It was lived before it was planned. And instead of a Protestant people or a fourth green field, it evolved as a place apart. Paradoxically, more distinctive from the places around it than any of its neighbours were from each other. Because contrary to nationalists, and this I'm going to humiliate you, contrary to nationalist simplicity, Northern Ireland was not just merely partitioned, it was devolved. So distance grew from the rest of Ireland and the rest of Britain to their great relief. Politics, history, memory and law inside the ghetto were all distinct. Paradoxically, this hermetically sealed model of impossible pluralism spawned and legitimated violence, extremity and fundamental nationalism on all sides. But the more we fought to belong, the more we alienated our neighbours. Britain lost interest in empire and Ireland was embarrassed by murder. Reading Hewitt now, I'm confronted, I think, neither with an apologist nor a detractor for Northern Ireland, but by a man who's both at home and stranded in this new reality. In a sense, he tries to retrofit Northern Ireland. What is striking reading him now is both the naivety of his appeal to geography and the prescience of his conviction that something distinctive had been brought to existence. I am sympathetic to the enterprise, if not finally to his conclusion. The word region is too technocratic. A label for a district or a subdivision which raises all sorts of questions about what divisions are right and wrong, but there's something important here, and I won't go too long, I'll just say a couple of things. The word region of a concept brings forth all sorts of possibilities. Philosophy and ideas in the region of geography and place, district. History and politics, regere, region, to rule, to direct. The body. And it brings forth, actually, for me, region, ideas of particularity and distinctiveness. It's different here. It's approximate in the region of. It's imprecise. It's both close to, it's a region of, and it's surrounding. It's related, it's interrelated, and yet it's distinct from. It's trying to get a grip on the very slippery nature of a place, not apart but between. Subsidiary to or subordinate to, dependent on, contributory to. Governed, self-governed. The notion of a region is itself intensely slippery. And I think what he's trying to say is, on the margin of nations, on the margin of geography, something else has to be given its place because it is measurably and visibly and tangibly distinct. Northern Ireland is, however, part and a part. It is dependent, it is interdependent. It is actually legally precise. And yet it is conceptually approximate. It is close to other places, and yet it is different from them. For nationalism of any sort, all of this is an anathema, an inconvenience. But what Stuart for me is striving to do is for a mechanism to celebrate its emergence, its predicament. Northern Ireland, whether we like it or not, has been for 100 years. It is a predicament which is there for all of us, and it is home. And a warning that any nationalism which seeks to make more simple that which is complex can only do that through enormous cruelty and violence. 100 years on, there's no doubt that Northern Ireland exists. Failing and failed as it is an experience parts of which you can only understand if you were there. It is a predicament which nobody wanted, but which has been sustained. It is a part and a part. Actually, for me, the agreement reaches for all of this. And does it actually? I'm a romantic about the agreement. Brilliantly. It reaches for beyond, not just a part. A place between, not simply separate. British, Irish, and both, as you may choose. Reconciliation as a vision, rather than a single national identity. But then in 2007, they handed it over to the nationalists. I suppose for me, the possibility is, the question is, can we still capture it? Can we still celebrate the possibility of its incompleteness? This is not a discussion of under which jurisdiction this will be, because this will have to exist even in whatever jurisdiction it will be. But it is a question of whether this can be a precursor to a more plural world as a way to recover from empire without the choice of being the diner or the dinner. But somebody will need to champion its cause, and somebody will need to stop seeing defeat in the failure of purity.
Lovely, excellent. It was really quite brilliant, I thought. Alex, in a way, what he's doing is providing a kind of a vision for unionism, you know, because if unionism made a case like that, which is that although Northern Ireland was part of this post-imperial remapping of the world and trying to impose ideas of nation on places that were diverse and split, that is actually the norm. That is what happened everywhere, and one that lasted 100 years, maybe, has more integrity to it than the others. I mean, I remember a discussion I was in during the worst of the Troubles, and people are saying, you know, this place is tearing itself apart, and somebody chipped in the idea, yeah, but what is it actually holds it together? And it does seem to be something that holds it together.
Well, in terms of unionism, I'm always wary when someone mentions unionism and vision. In the same breath, because even though I am an unashamed, unembarrassed, unapologetic unionist, I believe in the constitutional integrity of the United Kingdom. My experience of unionism is that when you give them a vision, they automatically assume it's to do them down and then tear it up and go off and have a parade somewhere. Yeah. But in terms of Northern Ireland working, you know, for 100 years, yeah. I don't entirely buy that, because for the first 50 of those years, from 1921 to 1972, a very, very substantial minority didn't believe Northern Ireland was their country, didn't believe it had any impact on their lives other than to be treated as second-class citizens. They didn't feel that they were part of a new, vibrant country, you know, which protected their rights, which protected their ambitions, you know, which even protected simple democratic things like how you voted, where you voted, how boundaries were drawn. So they had no sense of that. A very significant minority had no sense of identity with this Northern Ireland. Then for 25 years after that, from 72 when Stormont was prorogued to 1998, you had this huge tussle between the two big identities plus a middle ground, all trying to say what this country was, how it should be governed.
Well, do you have any thoughts on why the Troubles took 50 years to break out? I mean, I remember talking to Mitchell McLaughlin once, and he said, you know, in a way, he was kind of contemptuous of a more docile Catholic nationalist generation, which had not protested and had not broken the thing. But actually, you know, something must explain why they didn't.
Why they didn't break out?
Yeah. Well, then, Carrie, did you want to say on that?
Well, if you're looking at a society that emerged out of the Civil War, out of the trauma of the split, of the partition.
Yeah.
And I think you're also looking at something that comes in cycles and waves anyway. And I think right now we are in the middle, if not on the cusp, of similar wave that happened in 69 around the world as well, and that ignited the fires of revolution and change and just the ability for people to maybe emerge from World War II as well and say, okay, it's time to upheave, it's time to change the system, it's time to move and register our dissatisfaction. So I think part of why it didn't happen and then when it did was part of that cyclical reaction and wave back and forth between trauma and conflict and then upheaval to change. It's
natural. You say you're acting, but you don't buy that either?
No, no, no.